Bloom Shapiro, accounting, tax, and business advisors, asking the questions no one else asks, creating solutions no one else can. Because achieving your success is how Bloom Shapiro measures theirs. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. Larry Rifkin along with John Krawczyk. And John, this is such a crucial issue. And it's amazing how it has been submerged over the years as we have dealt with real crises, fake crises, crises of spirit and our political culture. And yet looming over the entire world is this potential apocalypse. Because we've got nuclear weapons in the hands of major powers, less than major powers. We've got various powers that are in various agreements with others, others that are running rampant without any agreement to contain or control their impulse to have these nuclear weapons of mass destruction. And I'm talking from a perspective of being someone who was in Hawaii when we had that missile alert a couple of years ago.
I remember that. Yeah.
And we really didn't know what to think, whether Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump, prior to having their meetings, were really going to go at it, and whether we were caught in the middle. And it's well, think about it, John. It's devastation, full and complete devastation.
That's for sure. Well, this is the worst thing, and this has been the worry for years. I mean, Russia had some suitcase nuclear weapons missing for a long time.
We think that non-state actors have them.
Right, exactly. So, I mean, this is a big problem.
But does anybody talk about
Nobody's talking about it. Well, are we still in Iraq and Iran? Nobody's talking about that. I mean, we're
not in Iraq.
Wherever.
Afghanistan.
Afghanistan.
Okay.
Let's get are we still anywhere?
We're everywhere around the globe. But these weapons of mass destruction, literally nuclear weapons, we're going back today to look at the history of the development of these weapons during an important, crucial moment in World War II. And we're going to be talking about Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We're going to be talking about the development of plutonium in Washington State at Hanford. A lot of people think about Oak Ridge, or they think about what went on in Los Alamos, but they lose track of what happened in Washington State and the impact of plutonium instead of just uranium when we developed that. And Steve Olson has an incredible book called The Apocalypse Factory. And so we go back, John, because that's not necessarily our stock in trade, though as part of America Trends, we try to give context, and then we bring it forward. Why is this issue of nuclear weapons not at the top of everyone's mind?
Right.
Are we protecting our own inventory? Are we looking to build more weapons? Are we looking to go forward with agreements that are about to come due at the beginning of next year with Russia? Or are we falling asleep on that? And what do we do about these rogue actors who are out there?
That's a very good question, and I wish I knew what was going on with it, because you're right, we've been left in the dark about a lot of stuff that is going on in this world, and we have no idea. It's all noise. We get filled with noise on the news, and we don't ever get real news and real investigative reporting.
Well, I've got to tell you that when you think about it, I don't know if we talked about it in the podcast because we recorded it about a month ago, but there is a part in the book about Enrico Fermi. What a genius. And he was sitting around with other geniuses and really smart people too. I don't know. I don't know how I want to categorize them. Mensa, super Mensa. Plutonium Mensa.
Some really, really, really smart.
Really, really smart people. And they were sitting around, I guess, at lunch. I don't know what really smart people eat for lunch, but they were sitting around talking about whether, in fact, there was life outside of the planet. And they said, well, if they were smart enough, really, to develop a culture kind of like the one we've developed, that probably by the time they would have reached the Earth, they would have destroyed themselves in the process.
Yeah.
And you think about it, John, because we have a podcast coming up that talks about the end of everything, how that will occur. I mean, some of the natural forces, and it will all end. I mean, the universe will end.
The sun will burn out or...
Right, exactly. You know, we'll get to that.
Asteroid.
But the point is, we on Earth, it could all be over tomorrow. With the wrong judgment made by people in power who have lost their way. Let's put it that way.
Okay.
All right. Let's talk about nuclear weapons. We're going to get you caught up to date on the history of all of this and then where we are today with Steve Olson on America Trends.
With me on the line is Steve Olson. The book is called The Apocalypse Factory, Plutonium and the Making of the Atomic Age. And in this particular conversation, folks, we're going to be talking about nothing less than perhaps the most controversial issue ever to inhabit American history, the dropping of the bomb, particularly over Nagasaki, though, of course, Hiroshima was first. And Steve, you give us at the beginning such a wonderful sketch of the dynamics of these scientists and the work that was going on under the rubric of the Manhattan Project. And you also bring us to Hanford, Washington. And I think many listening might remember Los Alamos, Oak Ridge, but Hanford really has been left out of the story for many.
It has been, yes. As I point out in the book, Los Alamos and Oak Ridge get much of the attention in histories of the Manhattan Project and of the subsequent Cold War and the production of nuclear weapons during that time. But I make the case that Hanford is the most important site of the three in the Manhattan Project and also the most important site of the nuclear era in its production of plutonium for nuclear weapons, both during World War II and subsequently.
Well, you might as well, and most of us are laymen, walk us through the use of uranium in the first bomb, then plutonium, and we're today up to hydrogen. How much in the way of advances, if we want to call it that, are these changes?
Well, yes. After the nuclear fission was discovered in 1938, right at the end of the year in 1938, scientists realized pretty quickly that it would be possible to make a bomb out of a rare isotope of uranium if they could separate enough uranium from natural uranium ore to the bomb. But they also realized that was going to be a very difficult process. This rare isotope of uranium differs from the most abundant isotope of uranium just by a percentage or so in weight, and that was all they had to go on in trying to separate it out. So at that point, the prospects for a nuclear weapon, certainly in time to use during World War II, seemed very dim. But then, in 1941, a scientist named Glenn Seaborg at the University of California, Berkeley, discovered a new element, which he named plutonium, and realized fairly quickly that plutonium also could be used to make a nuclear weapon. So all of a sudden, the United States had two ways to make an atomic bomb. And government officials realized that if we had two ways to make an atomic bomb, then the Germans did as well. And so the motivation for beginning the Manhattan Project really stepped up greatly after the discovery of plutonium. In fact, I argue that the Manhattan Project likely would not have occurred if plutonium hadn't happened to be discovered in 1941. It's really sort of an amazing, lots of things had to come together for the Manhattan Project to get underway and to then succeed.
Absolutely. And were we a bit delusional about the ability of the German scientists? Was that really always in the back of our mind, driving us forward to find what it was that we could that might give us that critical advantage to end the war? And at first, we thought it was against the Germans, then ultimately used against the Japanese.
Mm-hmm. It certainly was a motivation for all of the scientists and engineers who were involved in the Manhattan Project. They really saw themselves, Glenn Seaborg included, as being in a race with the Germans. They had very little information about what the Germans were doing in with regard to their bomb-making program. There was a bomb-making program in Germany, but we had very little information in terms of espionage or any other source of information about how much progress they were making. So, yes, they were quite concerned that the Germans would be able to build a nuclear weapon and would use it to win World War II, and that the United States had to build one to counter the Germans, is essentially why the Manhattan Project was started. As it turns out, the German program never really got underway. Germany had the scientists who could do it, but for a variety of technical and sort of administrative reasons, the program faltered before it made much progress.
In your book, and I just want to read a brief passage, Hanford is where people confronted for the first time all of the dilemmas of power, pollution, destruction, and sustainability associated with nuclear energy. The laws of physics enable us to create substances that can release immense quantities of energy. This energy can power electrical grids, cure cancer, or cause it, and destroy cities. The substances produced in nuclear reactors will remain dangerous for hundreds of thousands of years, longer than we have existed as a species on this planet. As you go forward, and you have taken the entire sweep of this history, its uses to this point, and whether they have been generally for beneficent purposes beyond the two bombs dropped at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and whether, in fact, the worrisome notion of still having so many of these weapons available to us exploding onto the scene with countries with whom we have great concern. Tell us what you think on balance about what has happened since your writing of this book and you thinking about this issue.
Yeah, we should talk a little bit more about plutonium and how it's used, because I think that goes into the equation of the pluses and minuses of the development of nuclear power. So plutonium powered the very first atomic bomb that was ever used, the one that was tested in New Mexico on July 16, 1945. So we just passed the 75th anniversary of that event. As I say, the Hiroshima bomb used uranium from Oak Ridge, but the bomb dropped on Nagasaki uses plutonium. Now, after World War II, it was realized that plutonium is a much better substance to use as the trigger for nuclear weapons than is uranium. And so all of our nuclear weapons today are essentially built around a small pit of plutonium made at Hanford and also at a facility in South Carolina. And essentially they're built around a small Nagasaki type bomb. And that raises the temperature inside the bomb high enough so that, hydrogen in the rest of the bomb starts to fuse together. And so that's how hydrogen bombs work. It's essentially they are triggered by a Nagasaki-type bomb. And that's why all of our nuclear weapons today have some of the plutonium in them from Hanford. That's why I call the book The Apocalypse Factor, in fact, is because if these nuclear weapons are ever used, human civilization probably will end. It's hard to foresee a way in which the world would be able to survive the climatic and radiological consequences of a large-scale nuclear war. Nuclear power has had benefits. Nuclear technologies have had benefits, both in terms of the production of radioisotopes that are used in medicine and industry. They have had a big influence on industrial processes and medical practices over the past 75 years since the end of World War II. We also use nuclear energy, and it remains to be seen if a human population of the size that we have can be supported entirely upon with renewable forms of energy, or whether we're going to need some nuclear power to get us through a period in which we're going to have to quit burning fossil fuels.
And why is it that around the world, places like France have become more reliant upon nuclear energy than the United States, where all of this was designed and developed?
Yeah, France and to some extent, to a lesser extent, other countries made a decision at some point that they would throw their weight behind nuclear power and actually build a large number of nuclear power plants. I mean, here in the United States, we have around 100 nuclear power plants, I think still produce some 20% of our electrical energy. So we rely on nuclear power quite a bit ourselves, but not to the extent that France has. Those commitments are now being questioned and have been questioned, really, the large buildup of nuclear power plants in the 1960s, 1970s, and 1980s. nuclear power has both benefits and costs, and those have to be taken into account. One big cost, for instance, is what we're going to do with the spent fuel rods, nuclear fuel rods, that were used in nuclear power plants. So the United States has not agreed upon any place to put those spent fuel rods, and our efforts to establish a repository, a long-term repository, to store those things away from the environment have so far been unsuccessful. So all those fuel rods are just sitting around in swimming pools and in dry storage around nuclear power plants, and they do pose a substantial risk to the surrounding area. So that's certainly one of the costs of nuclear power that has to be taken into account in deciding whether to expand it or contract it.
Oh, absolutely. Now, I do want to talk about the decision to use nuclear weapons. You remind us in the book, by the way, it's a fascinating portion of the book, how we made the decision. There were no written commands for the bomb, not signed by the president himself. Was the idea to get Japan to surrender before the Soviet Union could join the effort and therefore have a territorial claim on Japan? Or was it that we really wanted to avoid the casualties that were imminent if we had to make an invasion of the mainland? We hear that often. Or was it the political risk to President Truman that people find out later that he had these weapons of mass destruction and didn't use them and therefore cost so many American lives, thus a political devastation to him?
It was really all those things and about 10 or 20 other things. There were so many things going on at the end of World War II that it's just a fascinating subject. And you can spend a lifetime studying the process by which World War II ended and the decisions that were made at the end of the war. Something like that is that a lot of the memos upon people-based decisions are now available on the Internet. So you can actually go read all those things and sort of reconstruct the way in which this happened. You know, there are certain narratives that we rely on in thinking about the end of World War II. For instance, that Truman faced the decision between dropping the atomic bombs and having an invasion of the Japanese homeland. When you look at the actual history of those few weeks and months in the summer of 1945, it turns out to be lots more complicated than that. And those narratives tend to have been applied in retrospect to this complicated process, often to make sort of political points that subsequent people wanted to make about how the war was going to end. There was a lot of technological momentum to drop the bombs. Many Japanese cities had been firebombed already. There were just a few that had not been essentially destroyed by conventional bombs. The process by which one bomb and then another bomb was dropped and the influence that had on the Japanese government is also fascinating. We've learned a lot more about that in recent years as documents have become available both from the Japanese and from the former Soviet Union about how this history worked.
The moral issues raised by the bomb by scientists involved in developing it, a very important and very interesting part of your book.
Yes, often raised subsequently by most scientists, but I do write in the book about the handful of scientists who realized even as the bomb was being developed, or in some cases when the possibility of a bomb was first envisioned, about the moral consequences of developing these kinds of weapons. It's a tremendous historical irony that the very first scientist to realize that a nuclear chain reaction was possible, a man, a physicist named Leo Szilard, was also someone who recognized almost immediately the moral difficulties of scientists being involved in developing these weapons. He was involved in developing these weapons. He was very concerned that Germany would build these weapons first and subsequently use them to really dominate the world. And he, for instance, is the one who went to Einstein and convinced Einstein to sign a letter to President Roosevelt saying that the U.S. government should mount a program to build these weapons first. But before the weapons were used against Japan, he was also issuing warnings to the U.S. government about the consequences and the moral problems associated with dropping these bombs. So he's just a fascinating historical figure.
The idea of a demonstration project as opposed to really dropping a bomb, what kind of serious consideration did that get?
was considered, not at the highest levels of government, but by groups of scientists and to some extent, military leaders who were thinking about the ways in which the bomb should be used at the end of the war. It was almost immediately dismissed for a variety of reasons. People would raise objections to the idea of a demonstration. They'd say, well, if we announce that we're going to demonstrate the bomb somewhere near Japan, the possibility that the Japanese will move American soldiers into that area, or perhaps the demonstration won't work, in which case we're not going to, in which case the war could turn out worse for us. And so the proposal for a demonstration was almost always shot down before it started working its way up the chain of command. You know, when you look at the history of how World War II ended, it's hard to figure out how a demonstration could have occurred. It was an interesting proposal, but there were so many factors arguing in favor of using the bomb that that I don't see quite how that could have ended up being the outcome.
We'll be back with more of this America Trends podcast in 30 seconds. At Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, discovering what makes you different is what makes us different. Our partners are true business advisors, listening, analyzing, asking the questions no one else asks, creating solutions no one else can, anticipating your future goals and drafting plans to make sure you get there. Because at Bloom Shapiro, achieving your success and satisfaction is how we measure ours. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
The book is called The Apocalypse Factory. Steve Olson, the author, is with us. The notion of dropping the second bomb, to what degree was that influenced by the fact that those who had worked so hard on plutonium didn't want that to look as if we were squandering the resource that was put into that? I hate to think of it in those terms, but did we really need to drop a second bomb?
Yeah, I think the main reasons that we did drop the second bomb was because of the person who was leading the Manhattan Project, a general in the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers named Leslie Groves. And he became convinced quite early that it would require at least two bombs, if not more, to convince the Japanese to surrender. And so it was always part of his planning to drop one bomb and then to drop at least a second bomb quite quickly. The first bomb was designed to demonstrate that the United States had mastered this technology and did have atomic bombs that could use. And the second bomb was designed in Groves' mind to demonstrate that we could make subsequent atomic bombs and that we could make as many as would be necessary to force the Japanese to surrender. So the initial plan almost always called for the dropping of two bombs. And it was Leslie Groves, the leader of the project, who not only established that thinking, but made sure in his planning for the final days of the Manhattan Project that this would actually have to happen. Now, it is the case that the second bomb was supposed to be dropped 5 days after the first bomb, but they knew after Hiroshima that the weather was going to turn bad, and so the bombing schedule got moved up to just 3 days after Hiroshima, and who knows if those two extra days could have made a difference. The Japanese did not surrender after the dropping of the first bomb, and so people use that to argue that that the second bomb was necessary.
And if you do go and read Steve's incredible book, get to the portion about the impacts on the people of Nagasaki. And I really appreciate, Steve, that you went into such detail introducing us to Dr. Shirabi. What a remarkable figure he was. I interviewed Susan Southard, who wrote a book about the people and the impacts on them. And before we go forward to talk about where we are in the nuclear age, which still rambles on today, even though it's out of public view in many cases. We don't think about it often. We are not provoked to really get into much of a debate about it today, though I wish we would. But remind us why that was so important to you.
Well, I spent a week in Nagasaki reconstructing, following what happened to a single individual in the minutes and hours and days after the bombing. So I really wanted to try to reconstruct what it would have been like to be just a half mile away from the bomb, which was his case. He was a surgeon at the University of Nagasaki Medical Hospital. He happened to be in a building built of reinforced concrete so that it wouldn't fall down in an earthquake, and Japan has lots of earthquakes. So Hospitals and schools tended to have thick walls in Nagasaki and other Japanese cities, and those are the only things that were left standing after the bomb hit. But that concrete also prevented him from absorbing so much radioactivity that he would die of radiation sickness, although he did get quite sick in the weeks and months after the bombing. It's an incredible experience to go to either Nagasaki or Hiroshima. I really recommend anyone should do it if they have an opportunity to do so. Heck, I'm sort of convinced that any national leader who controls nuclear weapons should be required to go to one of those cities and see what the effects of an atomic bomb are on the city. Incredible devastation, incredible human suffering at both an individual level and at a mass level, because tens of thousands of people are killed. And, in speaking about modern nuclear weapons, the bombs dropped on Nagasaki and Hiroshima were quite small by modern standards. A modern hydrogen bomb dropped in the middle of a city as those were would cause much more devastation and suffering today. We focus a lot of attention on the threat posed by climate change, for instance, to the future of human civilization, and ask whether we can continue along this course, while tending to forget that human civilization can end in just a matter of a few hours if a belligerent leader were to launch nuclear weapons, or if an accident were to happen, or if some hacker were to get into the nuclear controls and cause an inadvertent nuclear war.
And the U.S. has never renounced the use of the bomb. Should we have? I mean, it took us until, I think, 2009 or so to even apologize to African Americans for enslavement. Are we ever going to get to the point where we are going to, in some way, renounce its use?
I certainly hope so. We are headed in that direction, but there are powerful forces arrayed against a policy of no first use. People have been talking about it more and more, and I believe that there is room for progress, but it's still going to be a very difficult thing to do. The new democratic platform addresses this issue and talks about using nuclear weapons as as having only one purpose, which is to retaliate against the use of nuclear weapons against us. That's not exactly a no first use policy, but it is a step in that direction, and it may be a necessary step before we can actually get to the point where we say we, the United States, will never use nuclear weapons against another country unless nuclear weapons have demonstrably been used against us. In other words, one of the great concerns right now is that, and this has happened several times over the course of the Cold War, mistakes led people to believe that an attack was underway from another nation, and the United States, U.S. officials, or in some cases Russian or Soviet officials, had to decide whether or not to launch their weapons like nuclear weapons in their silos before they could be destroyed. In all those cases, sanity prevailed and nuclear war did not happen. But in these days of hacking and cybersecurity flaws, we have even more reason to be worried about nuclear war starting to actually.
And with the number of players who have nuclear weapons, the miniaturization of them, the attempts to modernize them, the U.S. plans for $1 trillion-plus modernization of the American nuclear arsenal. I've been reading that it doesn't look as if the Trump administration really has a strategy other than to have more and better and more powerful weapons than anyone else. And yet I read a headline, the threat of nuclear weapons is truly terrifying, and no one seems to be paying attention. Is that fair?
Oh, absolutely, yes. So far, the Trump administration has been focused on better nuclear weapons in that they're miniaturizing and modernizing their weapons. They're making it easier to use nuclear weapons, which should concern everyone. We haven't started building more weapons yet. But the Trump administration is withdrawn from almost every important arms control treaty negotiated over the past five or six decades at this point. There's pretty much only one left called New START. New START limits the number of deployed warheads that the United States and Russia can aim at each other. That treaty is scheduled to expire next February, February 5th, and unless it is extended, the United States and Russia could easily start building more nuclear weapons for the first time since the end of the Cold War. And if they start doing that, other countries could very well follow suit and be right back in an arms race like we were in the 1960s, 1950s, 60s, and 70s.
The numbers game about all of this, the United States, Russia, than any of those disparate unions of the Soviet Union in terms of where the weapons are. India, Pakistan, and China, of course. I'm reading where, of course, we are concerned about the Chinese arsenal and want to have that included in a New START agreement. Is that one of the holdups?
That is one of the holdups, although it doesn't make a lot of sense in that the United States and Soviet and Russia together have 10 times as many weapons as the Chinese do. We do need to be concerned about these countries that have relatively small numbers of nuclear weapons. So, you know, calculations show that if just 100 weapons were exchanged, say, between India and Pakistan, it could kick enough soot and dust up into the upper atmosphere to lower temperatures for a decade by several degrees, and the results would be widespread famine throughout the world, probably billions of deaths. So even a small scale nuclear war has these just absolutely dire consequences for everyone in the world, and that's just 100 weapons, much less the 3,000 that the United States and Russia have pointed at each other right now.
The nuclear triad, I know the president had some problem defining that, but if you could help us to understand where we deploy most of those weapons today and where we look to invest in the future and where this is all headed based upon what you've seen.
Well, coincidentally, I'm looking out my window right now toward the Olympic Mountains, although as is usually the case in Seattle where I live, they are cloudy. About halfway between me and the Olympic Mountains is a submarine base called Bangor Submarine Kitsap Peninsula Submarine Base. That is the largest stockpile of deployed weapons in the United States. And those are the submarines that patrol the Pacific. There are 8 submarines that sail out of the Bangor Submarine Base, just 20 miles northwest of Seattle. That is one, so the nuclear weapons on submarines are one leg of our nuclear triad. The other two are the nuclear weapons that are on intercontinental ballistic missiles, and those are scattered across the upper Midwest so that they can more easily reach Russian and Chinese targets. The third leg of what's called the triad are the bombs designed dropped by bombers, long-range bombers that would fly to whatever the target is and drop their bombs. Many people have argued that if the purpose of U.S. nuclear weapons is to deter other countries from using nuclear weapons against us, it's unnecessary to have three separate legs of nuclear weapons. That really makes it look as if the United States is intending to use those weapons in an offensive manner. And clearly, the leg of the triad that could be eliminated at great savings and would make the world much safer are the nuclear weapons that are in the intercontinental ballistic missiles that are in the Midwest. A powerful argument can be made that those missiles are outdated and actually make the world a more dangerous place rather than a safer place.
We've also heard about deterrence based upon mutual vulnerability, but then there's been so much discussion of space wars and missile defense. Is there really any defense?
I would say that most scientists would say no. That it's always going to be impossible to erect a defensive system that can't be overpowered by the number of weapons that already exist, much less new weapons that could be built to overcome any defensive system that exists in the future. Shooting down an intercontinental ballistic missile, it can perhaps be done every once in a while, and U.S. officials may be able to claim success on tests, although the tests are often very simple ones and the defenses are likely to fail as often as they work. It's also the case that, as has been the case since the end of World War II, if even a few bombs get through a defensive system that a country has set up to try to protect itself, it's just an unimaginable humanitarian catastrophe. Millions of people are dead and whole cities are being destroyed. There's no defensive system that can be envisioned that can work perfectly. And so,
is there any impetus for a no nukes movement? We heard about it some time back, but I'm just really wondering, do we have any chance of that?
Oh, absolutely. People are working very hard on this. A large number of groups are working on it, and they've made much more progress than I think most people realize. The International Committee on to Abolish Nuclear Weapons has passed a treaty, the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, and that treaty has passed through the United Nations, calls for all nations to eliminate nuclear weapons. The Non-Proliferation Treaty, which has been in existence for decades, calls upon the nations that have nuclear weapons to engage in negotiations and talks leading toward the abolishment of nuclear weapons. So this has actually been a goal for quite a long time. And we have made progress. And if we could continue to make progress, we could eventually whittle down these weapons to numbers where elimination of these weapons is conceivable. The problem right now is that, as I say in the book, we seem to be going in the wrong direction. All of a sudden, we're interested in making better weapons and more weapons. And that's exactly what we should be doing.
Steve Olson, I can't thank you enough. An incredible book, and you must read it and not to fall asleep on the issue of nuclear weapons, The Apocalypse Factory. Thank you for being with us today on America Trends.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
America Trends podcast is part of the MHNR Network, mhnrnetwork.com. At Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, discovering what makes you different is what makes Bloom different.